I'm Bay, and you're listening to Bay Baltimore, a weekly pop culture and society podcast recorded in a quiet neighborhood in Baltimore. This episode, I've been watching Web of Make-Believe, Death, Lies, and the Internet on Netflix for about 2 weeks now, off and on. Specifically, I've watched one particular episode that was uniquely disturbing to me, at least four times, because I wanted to make sure that I wasn't projecting my feelings onto the subject of the episode. But I watched it finally again last night, and I've come to the conclusion, no, I heard what I heard. I felt what I felt. My instincts were what they are. And so I want to talk about the entire series. I didn't finish all of it. I watched every episode but the last two, which was about the same singular case. But I'm going to talk about all of it. But there is something uniquely disturbing to me about that third episode that I just can't break free. Can't turn her loose. And so I'm just going to talk about it. I'm going to talk about the whole series, well, most of it, but I'm definitely going to talk about the series through the lens of that particular episode, because that was wild to me. But first, I did want to make mention of the Umbrella Academy season 3. It came out over the weekend, and there are already think pieces about the ending all over the internet. And the only thing I can say is that, you know how shows go. They jump shark at a certain point. They get weird. The reference jumping shark is actually a Happy Days reference. When Google Happy Days, it was a popular show, I think back in the 80s and 90s. Maybe it was the 80s. It was probably just the 80s. But it starred, what's that guy's name? He played on Andy Griffith. The kid from Andy Griffith became a movie star, like a TV star, and then he became a director. I cannot remember his name, but I can see him. He had reddish blonde hair, and then he got older and was still pale and lost a little bit of his... He's a director. He's a big-time director now, but the little boy from the Andy Griffith show. Anyway, Happy Days was the show that he was on, and the coolest... arguably the coolest character on Happy Days was the Fonz, who was played by Henry Winkler. And anyway, there was a point where the show was going on and was so popular, but it had reached its relevancy. And this particular show coined the phrase jump the shark, because literally the Fonz, there was an episode where he literally jumped a shark. He was like in the water or whatever, probably had his leather jacket on because that's what he was known for. But anyway, I don't remember watching the scene. At this point, I feel like I'm not even going to describe it. There's a point in which, because I feel like I'm making up aspects of it, but there's a point at which he literally jumps a shark on the show. And that signaled to many people the beginning of the end of the show, when the show had run out of good ideas. And while other shows, popular shows who had run its course, run for a decade or whatever, I don't even know how long Happy Days had been on by the time the Fonz did this infamous jump the shark episode came on, where it was the signal for the end. This is the end of the show. We got to stop this thing. Ron Howard is the director who he's a director now, but he was on Happy. He was in Happy Days. He was also the little boy in the Andy Griffith show. Anyway, I brought that up because Happy Days was a vehicle for his show. It was like an offshoot, I think, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was an offshoot of the Andy Griffith show, or maybe it was an offshoot of another show, like a spinoff of another show. Long story short, jumping the shark is a term that's used in TV. I don't know that they use it in film franchises, but they definitely use it in TV franchises when a show reaches the point where it's no longer really relevant. It doesn't really have any fresh new ideas. And so to keep it fresh, some ridiculous thing comes out, and this a ridiculous episode comes out where something just wild and outrageous to the show, to the plot of the show, to what you're used to, comes out and it falls flat. Like, it feels forced. It feels like you're trying to, it feels like you're desperate, because you are desperate to keep the show relevant. And so that usually signals the beginning of the end, or the end of the show. And so in this particular instance, it was literally the Fonz, the character, the Fonz, jumping a shark. And so we know that everybody famously said Weeds jumped the shark like a son of a gun. And I didn't even finish watching it because I thought the show was so ridiculous. And Parker Posey, I'm not always in the mood for her acting. Because it almost feels like she does the same thing, like the bug eyes and talks weird. Her phrasing is weird and she rests on her body. And that was not appealing to me. Also, I think the jump the shark moment I'll give you a prime example, something that made me mad. I don't even know why I was watching this, and I cannot remember if I've talked about this on the show or not. But something got in me to watch Orange is the New Black. And season 4 of Orange is the New... The show was completely ridiculous. And there were episodes that came close, or there were themes that came close to it jumping the shark. But season 5, I think it was all of season 5, whatever season it was where the entire season was essentially a couple of days. It was a prison riot. What led to the prison riot? Poussey's killing? Like, actually, even before Poussey's killing, before Poussey's murder in the show, the thing that led to that was literally the wild and weird major having an inmate, I can't remember the name of the inmate, but stand on the table for hours. That was the jump of the shark. I feel like that was the jump the shark moment for the show, where it started to imagine more brutal, inhumane treatment of inmates, as if there weren't other real life examples that you can incorporate. But because the show had left the book seasons ago, right? What we know is that the titular character, no, that's not titular, the main character, Piper Chapman, Piper, the real Piper, whose last name isn't Chapman, but can't call it. But her book, the show really ended after season 1. After anything after that was fantasy. And so, and most of season 1 was fantasy for the most part. Or a lot of season 1 was fantasy. Anyway, but that, whatever season it was, I think it was 5, it might have been 4. Whatever that season was, what led to that was the complete jump the shark moment. You talking about bad acting, bad rage, dumb plots, even dumber storylines. It was just ridiculous. And people, I think the thing that made it so unsavory, unpalatable for the viewing public. Now, this is when binging was still the rage on Netflix, and it was exclusive to Netflix. You couldn't binge shows on other, you couldn't binge new shows on other platforms. You could only binge shows and movies that had already come out, or series that had already come out, but not new ones. Netflix was the king of that. Now they're not, which is why they're doing everything to recoup the money that they're losing, because people are going to Hulu, getting the free subscription and calling it a doggone day, or the paying the premium, which is still less expensive than Netflix, what Netflix is doing. Netflix is about to go the way of Blockbuster Video. Watch. They're about to go the way of Blockbuster Video. Anyway, but that's not what I'm talking about. So jumping the shark, I think I've thoroughly explained jumping the shark for those of you who are not aware. So anyway, and to fill in the blank, any show that you've ever watched that was super popular, and then at one point there was this one episode or a series of episodes that you were like, okay, I've had enough. Typically those are its jump the shark moments. There are several others, but you get the idea. Anyway, and so every series creator and the actors in it, everybody that's involved in those projects has to really look themselves in the mirror and say, how long can we keep this thing going reasonably? Which is why I love miniseries or limited series, or I'm just generally speaking, the way that the UK that produces their shows. It's like, we only doing 4 and we calling it. Like, I feel good about these 4 episodes. Mm-hmm. we don't need three more seasons of this. We'll just do another thing. And I don't know if that was just because the British audience appetite for shows is selective, and so they will sit and watch for seasons, 20 years, one particular show, but like any of these newbies, like you got to hit it and quit it because there's no guarantee. I don't know the market there. I just know that there is an appetite for watching multiple seasons of a really good show. It's rare and actually kind of looked on as being avant-garde or at least forward-thinking for a series to only be four seasons long. People talking about Insecure and talk, oh, you ended it too soon. No, you didn't. They ended it just right. And to be honest with you, having the benefit of some time and distance between me watching the last episode and thinking back on it now, what, a year later, it needed to wrap up because it was that could have easily gone to 10 seasons. But they didn't have 10 seasons worth of material, but they could have made it into 10 seasons. But it was just getting stale. And they did hurriedly wrap up that final season, but it needed to be wrapped. So I'm not judging. But anyway, so, you know, shows on for 20 years, all those Law and Orders, I have given up. I gave Law and Order 20 years of my life and no more, because as I got older and I became more aware and more involved in my community, it was very clear to me that, well, and the fact that I learned that Mariska Hargitay's character is literally built on old girl that prosecuted the Central Park Five, but just like the ones who were exonerated, the exonerated five. And she was on some BS. So, but like Mariska Hargitay's character was built on this woman. You gotta be kidding me. Anyway, but I think I just got bored with that trope because it was just, it just felt weird and not appropriate. And Law and Order itself, like, honestly, Chris Maloney was one of the only reasons why I was watching that thing, because duh. But outside of that, like, I really didn't fool with that show like that. And then I just gave it up because it was repetitive and was all my nerves. And then again, I was just more in the community, and policing is not black and white these days, is it? It hasn't been as black and white as we want it to be on TV. Anyhow, but well, let's get back to Jumping the Shark. The reason why I'm talking about Jumping the Shark is because I think the Umbrella Academy has done it. They talked about, so when it started, again, the story itself wasn't too doggone difficult. You know what I mean? It wasn't too outlandish, but the approach to the story I thought was kind of cool. Time travel being a huge part of it. One sibling, spoiler alert, one of the siblings, we learned this in the first season though. We learned that one of the siblings, I think his name is Number Five. He has a name, but he's called Number Five because that's how they were named when they were adopted. Number Five had the ability to harness time and space or be able to travel between two points in time and space, something like Doctor Strange, right? And all of that mumbo jumbo. Not mumbo jumbo, but like, you already know how I feel about Doctor Strange. Anyway, if you don't, go back and listen to that last week's episode where I ranted about Doctor Strange being totally irrelevant. Essentially, that's in a nutshell. Anyway, and that everybody else was more important, including America, America Chavez, but whatever. It's his movie. Moving on. And that bad wig. Moving on. But yeah, so Number Five can manipulate time and space. And he's young. He's a child. I think he's like 13 at the time. So he's like a teen. And an angsty teen at that. And so something happens where uses his power, only it pushes him too far into the future and now he can't get out. And the too far is literally at the end of the world. And so he literally spends 45 years on, or at least 40 years, on his own, living at the end of the world by himself, not met another soul. Well, except anyway, there's some details that I don't want to give you because, at this point, you should know that there's a whole corporation that was organized to be able to manage space and time and folks with powered people to make sure that they're walking in line, because there's an agency for everything, including an agency for powered people who have the ability to manipulate space and time. And this agency has the total, complete control to be able to manipulate time and space. And there's something that we learn at the end of season 3. I'll just go ahead and say, I will say this. Oh no, do I want to spoil it? Okay, there's a tiny spoiler for the Umbrella Academy. And it actually should not come as a surprise to you, but I'm telling you now, I'm about to spoil it. So skip forward like 2 minutes, okay? Skip forward like 2 minutes, all right? I'm going to be quick. All right, number 5 actually created the corporation. We learn that. We don't learn the details, and I imagine in season 4 we're going to learn more of the details, but he actually created it. And the how we get there is really interesting. So I do encourage you to watch it. But, okay, spoiler over. I think ultimately, spoiler over, and I'm talking about other stuff now. I think I don't like this season, and I think this season is the Jump the Shark season, even though maybe it's Jump the Shark-esque. Like, it's getting doggone close. But that last episode, I don't know if there's going to be a season four. There may be, because, you know, you can always come back. You can always find a reason to pull people back, but no, man, it's so I actually find of all of the folks' story, they really wanted us to really focus on the big guy and his growth and change and all of that stuff. But it was just, no, he was in love with his sister. Even though it wasn't his blood sister, he was still in love with his sister. And then poof, you want me to now follow this new line where he's now moved on and is in love with his alternate universe, his twin or something, like the other sibling. Like, it's gross and it's weird. And I don't care. He's not that interesting. He's not that interesting. You literally had to make him part ape in order to make him interesting, and big and hulking in order to make him interesting. And he's not that interesting. He's not. He's not even that cute to me. But anyway, that was rude. He's not interesting as the character. His whole identity was to be big, hulking, and strong. That is all. Don't care. Because Klaus was more important. I don't even know what number Klaus was, but played by that, not Ed Sheeran. Anyway, there were other characters that were more interesting, but the most interesting to me was number 5. Because of that story, because the actor who played him is actually a teenager. Well, he's probably 20 at this point. But that was an actual child playing a child who was only a child in his body, but was actually like 40, 50 something, 45, 50 something, probably 60 actually, because I don't know how much time. He aged in his, he didn't age in his body, but he aged spiritually. And in his soul, he aged in his soul. And so this kid did a decent job of embodying a 50 something year old person in a 13 year old's body to the best of his ability. It was I think it was subtle ways. He just ended up scowling a lot. The actor did a good job, I think. But his story was the most interesting, and he was number 1. So he ended up leading a lot, and he was very ruthless. And what you see throughout the 3 seasons is him doing everything in his ability to protect his family. This adopted family who is better than is his family. And anyway, so his story was more interesting, and he delivers, in my opinion, more of the interesting lines in all of season 3, including a moment where he's talking with Elliot Page's character. And some wild stuff happened at the end of season 2, and there's some resentment that's carried in season 3. And anyway, so number 5 is talking to Elliot Page's character, who is now Victor, who's come out as Victor now. And he delivers something very important. And I'm just like, more of this interaction than this other forced, made for TV sort of acting type stuff. Like, this other stuff is trash. But that scene was pretty doggone important. But let me switch really quickly. Speaking about just overall diversity and just being open and more inclusive of everybody's identities. Everybody knows at this point that Elliot Page transitioned or came out as being trans, a trans man, two years ago. Before the filming, or maybe before, or came out as the filming began for season 3 of Umbrella Academy. And so there was no easy way for them to address it other than just straightforward. And so this character that was so totally female in Vanya that Elliot Page was playing, so totally tied to girlhood. The whole point of season 1 was to talk about how this poor little girl was drugged so that her adopted dad could control her better. And it was this whole big old thing around her. It was built around her being a little girl. She was just a little girl, but she had all of this power, and this little girl didn't know what to do. And so the end of season 1, Vanya lets loose and is now evil Vanya for a second. And then in season 2, she finds redemption. And then in season 3, Vanya awkwardly, there was no unawkward way to do it. They just needed to do it. It takes a moment. So they make her a lesbian. At first, they make her a lesbian, and she has this relationship in season 2. And then they rip her away from that relationship because that's what the show does. And anyway, in season 3, there's a moment where she said, Elliot Page's character says, you know, that person who was named Sissy, that person let me recognize who I am. I felt like I could be who I am. She encouraged me to be who I am. And the who that she ended up being was actually Victor. So instead of being Vanya, Vanya changed their name to Victor and said, basically gave his preferred pronouns as he, him, came out to his whole family, and then it was like an acknowledgement, and then everybody moved on. But it was so awkward. Like, they, in trying to be cool, it ended up being awkward. And I imagine that there was probably some other ways to get there. But like, when you lack imagination, I get it. And that was harsh what I just said, but the reality of it is this season to me felt like it was jumping the shark a little bit. The only thing that's interesting is number 5 storyline, and I'm only interested in number 5 and what happens in number 5. And old girl that does the rumor, I don't know her name and I don't remember her number, but where she echoes, like, she was dealing with some for realsies trauma, but the way that they I don't like how they addressed it. Like, they made her seem overly emotional, overly agitated, like overly emotional and unnecessarily agitated. She literally built relationships with 2 people and then lost them and was meant to just move on. Nope, they just kind of like, oh, well, girl, that it happens. But she literally had a whole daughter and a whole husband that no longer exists in the time frame that she was living in. And she desperately wanted to get back to them. More than saving the world, she wanted to get back to them. And that was so heartbreaking. And they did not spend nearly enough time on that storyline. So, okay, so it's number 5 storyline and then it's hers. Those are literally the only storylines I care about. Everything else just feels like it's superfluous. It's just extra. It's just doesn't have much of a point to me. Except the overarching theme of who the heck the corporation is. I'm calling it a corporation. I don't remember what their actual name was. But anyway, who the heck they are and understanding where the genesis of it and all of that. So anyway, I don't know if I'm going to talk about it next week. I've talked a lot already. but I haven't talked about all of the details in the show. I might not end up talking about it just because I'm something about that third season just don't sit right with me. And I just need to, I need time to marinate on it. But anyway, but I'm not here to talk about the shows that I may not talk about. I'm here to talk about the one that I do want to discuss. And so, yeah, I got to think about how I'm going to address this, because again, I really need to get to see, I need to get to episode three. I need to get to episode three. And I think I'll just start with episode three. So I'm not going to go in order, but I'm going to start with episode three. And then I'm just going to spread out from there to the other episodes and I'm going to pull from them. But episode three, when I tell you that that thing did not sit well in my soul, when I tell you it disturbed me, you need to believe it, because it disturbed me for a reason that seemed so innocent, but it was the most innocent seeming insidious behavior oftentimes presents itself as innocent and banal. And that's what I'll leave you with here. I will tell you why I got there. If you've already seen it, you know what I'm talking about. But I'm gonna jump into the next episode. So stay tuned. All right, so I have decided to start by reading a quote from episode three, I Am Not a Nazi, of the, what am I talking about? Of the Web of Make-Believe, Death Lies in the Internet. Okay, dear, here we are. It's such a wild journey. Actually, some of this is in the, what do you call it? The trailer for the show on Netflix. So some of this you should have heard, but I'm going to give you the whole excerpt, or the one where it just got to me, turned my blood cold. And I'm going to tell you why, in a second, but let me just read this. It's such a wild journey, because in the beginning, in the beginning, you're like, no, I'm one of the good alt-right people. I just believe in this. I just believe in that. I'm not a Nazi. They're just the extremists. And the speaker continues. And then it gets to this point where you start to see swastikas and you start to see pictures of gas chambers. It's not conscious. It just happens. It's like drinking. The more you drink, the higher your tolerance, the more you drink. It just keeps escalating. And then I was in it. This is the featured speaker, or the subject of episode three, I'm Not a Nazi, talking about her time in the in a white nationalist group that was connected to Proud Boys. The group is called Identity Europa. And I'll get into Identity Europa in a second. But this is her describing how she got into this white nationalist movement. And spoiler alert, I'll just go ahead and tell you to the end, she was part of the group, but was not present, but was definitely part of the organizers who led to the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville back in, what was that, 2017, where a woman died and several people were injured because that white nationalist decided to run them over with their car. But we'll get to that in a second. Actually, I don't even know that I'm going to go too further in the detail, because I think this first sentence is meant to be salacious and bring you in, but it's actually insidious to me. And not for an obvious reason, or maybe it's obvious to you because you grew up in the tradition that I grew up in. I I have so many thoughts running through my head, but this statement, it's such a wild journey because in the beginning, you're like, no, I'm one of the good alt-right people. I just believe in this or I just believe in that. I'm not a Nazi. They are just the extremist. That statement right there turns my blood cold. Well, what do they say? What's the saying? How's the saying go? Makes my blood run cold. Because the lack of accountability in that statement betrays her ultimate, in the whole episode, the whole point of her even coming on camera and talking about it is her saying this was a bad idea. It was more than a bad idea. It hurt people and somebody got killed. This phenomena is an extremist movement that needs attention. And it's too easy to be indoctrinated. Well, we know, girl, we know that extremist organizations, any extremist organization, any cult organization works really, really hard to be stealth in their indoctrination of you or indoctrinating you into their group. And I'm not trying to be unkind because I do feel like people fall victims to naivete all the time. But what you won't do is tell me you just fell into a white nationalist group at a book burning. She is describing this as she's saying her introduction to this white nationalist society is being at a book burning. You know what books they were burning? Books of Jewish authors. You know what they were saying? First off, how dumb can you get to buy books to burn them? You might as well just burn the money that you use. That's just like people buying CDs of remember back in the 90s? Well, if you're of a certain age, you probably don't remember. But if you are a my age group or older, you remember in the 90s that they were burning NWA, burning and crushing NWA tapes and Uncle Luke tapes because they were obscene. But if you are older than me, then you remember back in the 70s when that DJ from Chicago pulled all of these disco albums into, I guess he was called himself a rock DJ in Chicago, and pulled all those disco A-tracks and records and encouraged all of Chicago and the Chicagoland area to come to, I think it was Cub Stadium or some junk like that. And was it Chicago? Anyway, it was one of those bigger Midwestern cities. It wasn't Detroit. It was either Detroit or Chicago. It was one of them. Anyway, and they literally destroyed all of those records, which I think is the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. It's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. You're going to literally spend your hard-earned money, somebody hard-earned money, and then you're going to burn it? You might as well just burn the money, dummies. But you wanted to show, you wanted to protest, you wanted to prove a point. What point were you proving other than you're dumb? No, more than that. It's not dumb, because I need to stop using the term dumb. You bonehead. What a bonehead. Like, and it's a conversation with yourself, baby. You're not making a statement except to anyone but yourself. Because the people whose product you are destroying already got they money. And their distributors, everybody got their cut. You done bought it already. You want to make a statement, go steal it and then destroy it. But you're not finna do that because it's not about that. It's literally about the show. But anyway, let me not get back. That disturbed me, y'all. I was disturbed to my core. Not that the other episodes that led to this one weren't also disturbing. The very first episode in the series is about doxing. Doxing is dangerous. Literally, in this scenario, this person doxed 50 some odd people, probably more than that. Teenager, malcontent, because he was drunk off the power of being able to make someone scared and potentially risk someone's life. He was even doxing for hire. And it was in a doxing for hire scenario where a person in Wichita, Kansas lost his life. I got people in Wichita, Kansas. And you know the messed up thing about the whole thing? It was the wrong house. They doxed the wrong house. It was over a dollar. It was like a $1.50 bet or something like that, a game or something. They were gamers. The whole first episode is all about gaming. What we know is if you're on TikTok and you're on Black TikTok, then you know Patrick Gentry is a big time creator, and he's a DJ too. And some people that don't like him, some other big time creators that don't like him on TikTok, had doxed him 3 times in a month. And the last doxing incident, the police came to his apartment, and his children were there. One of his children answered the daggone door. He was super calm at this point, but that's a trauma response at this point. He couldn't be outraged. How outrageous is that? That's completely outrageous for the police to be called to your home. We already have a tenuous relationship with the police. We, all of us in major cities, at least, shoot, across the country. Listen, let's be for real, because I didn't heard this. I don't hear it nearly as enough. But when we moved out of Kansas City, we lived in the country. And when I tell you some of those quote unquote rednecks were like distrustful of the cops, for the same reasons that people of color in the cities are distrustful of the cops. Like, rich people want to divide poor people or low income people. Ain't no divide. Ain't no real divide except the one that they create. But I'm moving on. But we've been knew that. But rich people don't benefit when we're united. There is no benefit there, which is why they keep making poor people aspire to be rich, saying like it's attainable, knowing good and hell well it ain't attainable for the average Joe to be no doggone millionaire. But they still out there. Let me get back. What was my point? Doxing is dangerous. Doxing can get people killed. Not to mention, doxing can scar people for life. It was a big old trend. I didn't even realize people were still doing that. I thought there was laws put in place to throw people up under the jail if you were caught doxing somebody, because it's that doggone dangerous. We know police officers have a hard time not pulling their trigger. Okay, and so now, and maybe that's unfair, but I'm just saying, we have more incidents than we don't. Of police brutality, or not even police brutality, it's accidents with guns, justifiable shootings of innocent people because there was a perceived threat. Anyway, I'm not meaning to go there, but like, I'm just saying, like, there's a whole lot of evidence that suggests we got to do something different. Many people are calling for the abolishment of it to create a new thing. Some people are saying, let's reform the heck out of it. Whatever. The point is, something needs to change, and everybody recognizes that. The what is debatable, but that it does isn't debate. It's not up for debate. And so you're literally calling these people, you're using it as a weapon, and you're hiding behind a screen. The person that was doing it in the first episode hid behind a whole pseudonym screen and everything. He literally had nothing going for him in his life, so he projected all of his feelings of powerlessness and turned it into power, and then wielded that power over people that got on his nerves when they were in the game, and then turned to for hire and would brag about it. Because at the end of the day, if your whole personality is built on how tough you are, it only works if you tell people and people believe you, if people know you're that tough guy. And so what happens with all most ego-driven internet thugs is they tell on themselves. And the paper trail is long, and anybody watching, all they need to do is get one thread and they will pull the whole thing, and the whole garment comes undone. And that's what happened in this first episode. I cannot recall the second episode because, hold on, let me take a pause really quickly, because that one stood out to me because a man lost his life, and there's an underlying police brutality piece there, because the officer that ultimately took his life fired when told not to, and ultimately was cleared of any wrongdoing, but in Wichita had a history of shooting citizens. And so there was another story there that the series creators just didn't want to explore. And I'm tripping hard because that was a good story that should have been explored. And they summed it up in what, 30 minutes? You know what I mean? Hold on. Let me get the episode, guys, so I can tell you. Death by SWAT was the first episode. The reason why I couldn't get next to the second episode is because the parents' grief is the reason why it was hard for me to wrap my brain around that episode, because I can't ignore grieving parents and then their grief being misused. I'll get into it in a second. Or maybe I'll just talk. Well, but let me do this. Let me say this. So you got a person hiding behind a screen to feel powerful. Ultimately goes to jail because he should be in jail because he murdered someone. He set it all up. Emptied out whole arenas. I think he emptied out a basketball arena at one point. Certainly emptied out schools with calling in bomb threats because he was a tyrant. Traumatizing people. Didn't think nothing of it. Got put in jail for doxing people. The first time, got out, started doing it again because it was cool, I guess. I have no idea. Now he's in prison for an even longer stint. This is a young person, P.S. But that power trip that he got was something appealing, something vicious, because it enabled him to feel the power that he didn't feel in his own life. And you know the other messed up thing? That dude threatened his own grandmother to not tell on him. How you gonna do that to your grandmother? This is the person that took care of you when your parents split. Both of his parents split. The only person that cared for him was his grandmother, and he gonna threaten her. Anyway, that didn't sit right with me. That episode didn't sit right with me, but I hastened on because I'm just like, who? What do you do with this? Because again, the point of the show, the point of that episode was this swatter. Death by SWAT was the title. By the way, I did not do my due diligence. This series came out in on the 15th, so 2 weeks ago, by the time I'm recording this. So episode one was about a guy you kind of using the anonymity of the internet and a pseudonym to get the power in social media that he didn't feel in his real life. The second episode, a murder in DC, is about a whole party of individuals who used death as a way to sow discord and bolster their claims. Now, I'm not gonna go too deep in this because everybody understands what was happening in 2015 and 16 was like a doozy for us, right? 15, 16, and 17 was a doggone doozy for a lot of people. And it ushered in a lot of the foolishness that we're dealing with today, but it didn't usher in all of it. It basically just hastened on and exacerbated what many Black folks had been feeling already, right? And so this particular episode, I think the thing that hurt me the most about it, and I just couldn't watch it more than the one time I did, was the fact that there was a DC staffer who was killed, arguably, in a stick-up, because stick-ups do happen everywhere. They're more common in cities, but stick-ups happen everywhere, and stick-ups turn deadly happen everywhere too. I don't know why we allow ourselves to be fooled into thinking that deadly stick-ups only happen in the city. They don't. They happen everywhere, and they happen often. But nevertheless, this DC staffer dies, and the Republican Party, especially the Republicans who are chilling in DC and wanting to try to usurp power, use every opportunity to turn this into a suspicion game and link it back to Hillary Clinton and try to discredit her and the Democratic Party. And then Julian Assange gets in here. You know what? Julian Assange never really sat right with me. There was something about him that never really sat right with me. And now we know that he was Republican leaning. He was aiding the Republicans in that election. And with leaking that information, the way he leaked it, just putting it out there, you know, just asking questions. You know how trifling folk do. I'm just asking questions. No, you were making suppositions and leading people to the answer that you want them to get for your own benefit. Julian Assange never sat well with me. And I think the more that people who didn't look like me championed him, the more suspicious I was of him, because I never it never felt like he was doing it to be altruistic or to really just help the people. It felt like an ego trip. Also, he was currently still awaiting trying to dodge extradition, I think, on some sexual assault charges. So that's another reason why he was literally being made a martyr, or literally being made into this huge figure that also had a sexual assault charge on him. And people were like, oh, that was just put on him because he's telling what these other people don't want. Nah, man, like, no, it never did set well with me. And now I know why. And I wasn't the only one. It didn't set well with a lot of people, but you couldn't quite put your finger on it, could you? Couldn't quite put your finger on it, except with that sexual assault charge. But now we know, because he was in league with conservative, like ultra conservatives. And Russia, probably getting money from Russia. Anyway, but the thing that hurt me the most about this episode was that parents who are grieving their child's murder still to this day do not have a culprit for it. And every time, the thing that hurt me, when that mama said, every time this story comes back up and every time we have to put it back on the focus being on finding my son's killer, a little piece of our son dies again. We have a little less of him every time we talk about this story. And she's saying this as she's talking about the story yet again. I just couldn't, it was rough. They're from Minnesota. Not that that means anything. I guess my point is, I said that to say, just replace Minnesota from, and think people who were simple, simple life people. People who just minding their business, being regular, being used as props, and not allowed to properly grieve the death of their child. I think it was their only child. There was something about that I couldn't even watch. I watched the whole thing, but I couldn't absorb the entire story and how they were being used, that story was being used. Because at the end of the day, there were investigations and the Republicans who propped it up and said, oh, blame it on the Democrats. It was everything they were doing was found out to be a fabrication. But in the middle of all of that back and forth, the thing that was missing was who took their child? Who took their child's life? That's the thing that hurt me the most. Even the storytellers, that yes, they these parents were the subject. But even in the telling of it, I still don't feel like enough respect was paid to them. Their pain. You saw the pain on their faces and they cried and their crying breaks and things like that. But like, it didn't do it for me. It didn't do it for me. I'm on IMDb and Death by SWAT has 7.2. That episode has 7.2 stars. A Murder in DC, the one I'm talking about now, has 5.9 stars. And I think probably it has 5.9 stars for the same reason that I'm frustrated by the episode and I only watched it the once, because it's not a full story. You literally just told the story of misusing his death. You didn't tell the whole story of how it ruined his parents' life as well. Not only does the death of a child just change everything, I imagine, for parents, especially a grown child who was out there doing it, you know what I mean? Had got out their small town, was living life, doing things, about to change the world, life taken. And you can't even properly mourn and try to get police to lean on officers to find the culprit. For all of this foolishness that lasted, 3 years going back and forth between the parties? And so it got a 5.9 because, again, I felt like I would have rated it about that too, because there could have been more attention paid to the family. Episode 3, the one I am most disturbed by, I Am Not a Nazi, got 5.6. So let me go back to it. Again, it's such a wild journey because in the beginning, you're kind of like, no, I'm one of the good alt-right people. I just believe in this, or I just believe in that. I'm not a Nazi. So in you not describing what the things that you believed, see, this is why I don't trust the subject. I'm a little bit leery about the subject, because the things that she said that she believed in sounded like they aligned very much so with the ideals or the core values of white nationalism. But she did not consider herself to be a Nazi. You see how hard you got to fight? You see how hard that fight is? Even in explaining that, I'm sitting up here scoffing at my own self to even say the sentence aloud. I'm one of the good alt-right. What the heck does that even mean? Because what do we know that is associated with alt-right and conservative right? Women's rights. Let's be for real. And I am a religious, spiritual, practicing Christian. I do not believe that the Bible backs up the puritanical ways in which conservative Christians view and portray Christianity. I don't. I understand all of the pitfalls and the challenges with the religion. I'm not ignorant to those. But this image of what Christianity is and how it's performed and conservatism is from the white American perspective is not one that I subscribe to. And let me tell you this. You know, there is, so what we know is, to even to this day, it's still one of the most segregated spaces in the entire country is 10 a.m. on a Sunday morning, even to this day, because even though there's lots of the integration, we live in an integrated society, we still very much do worship separately, mostly. And so what I was reading, I think I was on TikTok the other day, and I was watching a short little clip from this theological scholar who was saying there is a fundamental difference between black worship in Christianity and white worship in Christianity, culturally speaking. White worship, or culturally white worship, in those spaces is talking about preserving what you already got. You got everything you need, so let's just find a way to preserve it. Right? Stay with me. And in the black spaces, culturally black spaces, it's all about the hereafter. It's all about the hereafter and reward elsewhere, because, right? So what are the assumptions there? In the culturally white Christian spaces, it's I got everything I need, I don't want it, and nobody should take it from me. God, continue to preserve what I got, which could translate to I don't feel like being generous. I don't want to pay more taxes. I don't want to have to give more to the poor. I don't want to have to give up my wealth. That might be a stretch for some people. It ain't a stretch if you consider it culturally. Just thinking of, look at our policies. Look at it. Why is there such a divide between black Christians and non-black Christians, specifically white Christians, in political spaces? Again, that political conversation has its place, but think about it. I'm not saying anything that's radical right now. I'm not even saying anything that's conspiratorial. Literally, the practices, what a lot of these white evangelical churches spew out, they say it's based in Bible doctrine, but it feels very warped. Again, the concept, for the most part, again, if you believe me, you believe me. If you don't, I get it, because it feels hard to say. But like growing up in the black church, actually being a part of, so I grew up in churches, but the first churches that I attended were not black spaces. They were non-black spaces. They were non-black spaces. And so I do remember, at least from my perspective, I can't say that this is in the Appalachia, you know what I mean? It's not, this is not across the board. I'm just saying in general, but it's not necessarily across the board. It totally depends on where you are and what sort of, again, Appalachian churches are probably very similar in a lot of ways, especially the holiness churches. Not holiness churches. What are the ones where they do the snake dancing? That's not prosperity. And again, we know that in a lot of Black churches, there was a time where prosperity preaching, which is very much give me all of this right now and let me maintain it, is very similar to overall that feeling. What I was describing in the approach in many in white cultural Christian spaces, culturally white Christian spaces, not all, but many. It's an overarching theme. Let me keep what I got. And many overarching theme in many Black, culturally Black spaces. My reward is over there. My reward is not here. My reward is over there, which betrays an understanding that, listen, I got a hard way to go here, so I have something to look forward to, which has been the theme of our relationship with Christianity since the beginning of this thing. At least Black Americans in the United States, in North America, in the Caribbean, that's been our relationship to Christianity and certainly our approach to it. And so anyway, why did I bring that up? I'm bringing it up because going back to that point, you got ideals that align. If you're saying that you want to keep what you got, the alternative is I'm not giving what I got. That's the alternative. Or I'll only give you what I want to give. I will not sacrifice more than what I want to give because I like my life. I like what I'm doing here. And doesn't the Bible talk against that? But I'm not here to preach. What I'm saying is that sometimes the lines that we justify as being so wide and so long that separates us from someone who is unsavory oftentimes are very thin. And in this admission, she literally said she betrayed her own. No, I'm one of the good alt-right people. I just believe in this or I just believe in that. I'm not a Nazi. Well, what are the things that you believe in? Because there was clearly something that you believed in that wasn't too far off from what these white nationalists that you were hanging out with. And that to me is insidious. She didn't even know that. And as exposing herself to be an ex-Nazi, an ex-white nationalist, she didn't even grasp that. And maybe she was nervous and speaking out of turn. I don't think so, though. I think she rehearsed what she said. I think she's probably still unlearning some things, but she hasn't unlearned that. I think she hasn't admitted to herself. And that's the thing that made my blood turn cold. She's not even admitting in this episode about exposing the alt-right and exposing white nationalists that she herself had fundamental ideas that were not far off from theirs. And that's the insidious nature of racism in America. That you can trick yourself into thinking you're not one of them. But look how quickly, and then she said, literally, the next thing she said, I'm not a Nazi, they're just the extremists. But you in league with them. You in league with them. Literally, what is Identity Europa all about? It's supposed to be a Nazi light. And they don't even use it, according to the documentary, because I refuse to give them any traffic on the social media or in the search engines. You're welcome to do whatever you want to do. But for how it was described there, and then maybe I do need to. Anyway, I don't feel like doing it I just don't feel like it. I just hope to stumble on the information or maybe just ignore the thing completely. I don't know. Maybe I'll go to a library. Anyway, the whole idea was a separate state for white people. Literally, take Wyoming, kick every indigenous person out, every person of color, every new immigrant, and make it a white state that you can come and visit if you want. You don't have to if you're white, only live there. But this is a space dedicated exclusively for whites. It's almost as if they were taking the notion of reservations and making it into, but for white people. But of course, it wouldn't be the deplorable conditions that many reservations find, the people who live on reservations find themselves in, because they have to fight for the resources that they need to survive. Now, mind you, it's not all gloom and doom, but here's the point is they were relegated to these spaces. And many of those reservations are in some of the white states that they want to create. Identity Europa wants to create. And this is probably a gross oversimplification, but it's like, they're not talking about necessarily eugenics. They're not even talking necessarily about violence as described in the episode. They're not necessarily talking about those things. What they're saying is we can achieve this separate. We want a space that are just for white people, just like you want a space for your culture. This is our culture, and we want a space for ours, and we can do it peaceably. It doesn't have to be by bloodshed. It doesn't have to be by force. And again, she goes into, and this is probably the reason why it's 5.9 on, what is it? Yeah, 5.6. Because there is no interrogation, at least that we saw, of how she got there. She told us how she got there, but there's a lot of holes missing. She says, there's a lot of holes in her story. She says, she got there because, you know, she had a rough childhood. She had a rough childhood. Her parents split. She lived with her grandparents for a minute, but she had to get out of there because she just had a lot of angst, a lot of self-loathing, didn't really have an identity of her own. She pushed a lot of people away because she was just hurting. And one night she was at a bar. She found herself at a bar entertaining a man that was completely captivating. And he turns out, he charms her, she says. He's super smart. Every time she thought he was going to end a sentence one way, he ends it a different way. Which just sounds like a confusing ass conversation to me, but whatever. Because how can you not follow someone in a story? Like what? Like if, anyway, what she was describing just didn't sound like, it sounded like she was grasping onto someone who was charismatic is what it sounded like. And he was charming in the moment, and she wasn't really listening to what he was saying. And that's what she needed in her life at that moment. Someone who was completely captivating, was attracted to her and was giving her attention. And so anyway, so she comes to find out, like, I think, I can't remember if the bonfire incident where they're burning books by Jewish authors and spouting out racist remarks, bring back the death chambers or whatever, or the gas chambers, and reference to the Holocaust. I never say it Holocaust. Do I say Holocaust? Holocaust. No, it's Holocaust. Anyway, just felt funny to say Holocaust. The cost part is the thing that's getting me. I don't know why. Anyway, feels wrong. It feels wrong to say it that way, but maybe it's not. Anyway, I don't know how we got to the bonfire. I don't know where he was in her journey to the bonfire, but she found herself at a bonfire that was the culmination of a pool party. And this is the joke that's floating around social media. So if you didn't get it, here it is. You can go to a pool party and turn into a Nazi. That was her. That was her. The ridiculousness of that statement. She literally said that she felt uncomfortable. There was even a visual to attach to it where this white woman was at this group full of other white people who were drinking around this bonfire. And there was the person, people or persons that were throwing in books were spouting off anti-Semitic statements, which, can I just say this right here? I guess I don't understand. Well, racism doesn't have a rationality. You can't rationalize racism. It just feels, why am I saying why anti-Semitism? Because it's religious, but then why anti-Muslim rhetoric? Same reason. Anyway, it feels like a reach to, how about that? I know more Jewish people than I don't know. Well, that's not true. I know a lot of Jewish folks, some who are Orthodox. I know a few Orthodox. I know more. I know a lot of secular Jews, but I also know a lot of progressive. I think I know more progressive Jews than secular or Orthodox that I know. Baltimore is a hugely religious city, regardless of what folks think. There's the first basilica, Catholic basilica is here. Huge mosques, plural, that are here. And of course, there are huge synagogues who are here. Like, I'm talking about thousands of people who attend these synagogues, thousands of people who attend these churches and mosques, right? Huge churches. We're not unique in that. Cities just have huge religious centers. Anyway, I think it's just wild to me, like Kansas City, where I'm from. Kansas City, huge Jewish population. Kauffman Stadium. Like, here's my point. How are you going to hate somebody that's here, been here? It don't make any sense to me. And for what? They're religious practice because they don't look much different than you, white people. I guess that's the thing that's bothering me the most. Like, what are you hating exactly? Their yarmulke? That doesn't make any, their modest dress? Like, what are you hating exactly? The food that they eat, that doesn't make any sense. But then again, it doesn't make any sense to hate brown people either. I guess there's a color distinction there. And then some folks who are racist and Christian do the whole, I don't know. All of this is absurd, completely absurd. I feel like particularly in being anti-Semitic feels like you are working real hard to be as racist as you possibly can. Not because it's not equally, not because you're working real hard to be racist against black folks. It's just, you just find it any reason to be hateful, in my opinion. And maybe again, I'm not trying to be unkind here and playing oppression Olympics. It just feels like they're holding on to that. I don't know. Maybe I'm describing it weirdly. But I'm like, I just feels like more work to be racist than not be racist. But what do I know? I'm not a racist. Anyway, moving on. But let me get back to old girl. She's at a book burning. She's at a pool party that culminated in a book burning, and she stayed. And in the thing that made me so furious is the actor is portraying her as being kind of frightened and kind of staring around like, what the heck is going on? Girl, you know that didn't happen. You know that didn't happen. She's sitting up here trying to justify. How are you going to justify you being at a book burning, girl? Leave. You knew what time it was. They were literally shouting out the names of Jewish authors and putting it into the fire. You knew what time it was. What are you doing? And somehow you're a victim. You're not a victim, my dear. I know you want to be, but you're not. I think it just made me, it upset me. That third episode upset me so badly. Because of that she got in there and she's trying desperately not to make her into a victim, but the kind of, she's already positioned as a victim. Because again, her upbringing was a little sketchy and then she was with an abusive man. And I'm not saying that abuse, and I'm not saying that you can be stuck in situations that you never wanted to be in and then just ride the wave. But that's not what she did. She didn't just ride the wave. She became a leader. And she wouldn't even own up to the fact that she was perceived as a leader. And you can't tell me that you don't notice your ascension in an organization. Again, she was a part of Identity Europa. And she joined Identity Europa before her racist boyfriend did. Which should tell you something there too. She brought him to the group. So it's like on the one hand, she's telling us all of this stuff and exposing the white national movement, or at least how a person can get wrapped up in it. And she's talking about it innocently. Again, it's not something that's conscious. Yes, it was conscious, baby. You stood there at a book burning. You said that was your introduction. You knew where it was going. You had an inkling. You could, what is it? Logic. You could logic your, I can't even think of the phrase that I'm frustrated. But I can't even think of the phrase that I'm talking about. But you get what I'm saying. Like, you could put two and two together. You could walk down that road to logic and get that you're probably going to go down a path you don't want to be. If they're burning books by people who are explicitly Jewish or have Jewish phrasing in the title, not phrasing, but like something that has to do with Judaism in the title. They're burning those books because the writer or the subject or both is about Judaism, or are they Jewish? They're connected to Judaism. And that is the reason why they're going in the fire. And again, the thing that, so the actress that's playing her is like looking freaked out and like kind of frozen like a deer in headlights. That's some old passive aggressive, somebody else come save me because I don't have myself the agency to do anything about this, even to walk away. And so that starts her ascension. She slowly, again, she brings her boo at the time into Identity Europa. Again, they are supposed to be a different approach. We've been knew that there was supposed to be a different tactic to these white nationalist groups. And so she lays out how they did it. You put on the suits. What is it, Richard Spencer? You comb your hair, you look nice, smell nice, and you use the words, but the dog whistles. You throw in some dog whistles. You don't say outright that you hate black and brown people and Jews, but you throw around things and say, we would like to be separate from this. And again, she, the whole way through in describing that, is very passive about it. And it's like, well, I'm just going to do this just for a little while. You don't... The lack of accountability that she was taking while making it seem like she was taking accountability is the thing that upset me the most. Because all of her work, she literally became a figurehead in Identity Europa for women. And there was a lot of misogyny in there, but duh. People love warping the Bible specifically. And a lot of those folks were even secular, but somehow or another, Christian values, warped Christian values, made it into their principles. And so anyway, because again, we know the Nazi Party, including Hitler himself, was a-religious. I'm pretty sure he was a-religious. And anyway, so at least agnostic. They might have been agnostic. And so, but somehow or another, those warped principles, those principles came through, got warped. And then there was a way that women needed to be. Misogynistic, kind of skewed to what womanhood is. And so she became that model figure. And then she would go to these conferences and surprise, surprise, women would come up to her and say thank you. Or men would come up to her and say thank you for helping to my wife or my the woman in my life to see the way and help her become a woman like you. And I wish it was a woman like you and all of that stuff. And she's still like, oh, well, I'm just here. Again, complete lack of accountability. And then the end was the most depressing piece. So she was a part of a rally in Charlotte because she spent a lot of time in Charlotte. I think she got engaged in the white nationalist movement living in Charlotte. And so in May of, I think it was 2017 when this thing went down, where the guy used his vehicle to assault protesters at the Unite the Right rally. But there was a rally before that she organized in May in Charlottesville. And so... And it was super successful. And so what the Unite the Right did, because what we know is that there's not just one white nationalist group. There are many white nationalist group. And so white nationalist groups. And so they rallied around. They took the blueprint that she laid out for the successful rally in Charlottesville. And then they did it again. They put it all together and did it again in June or July, something like that. One of those warmer months. Which culminated in the death of that one woman and many people being severely injured. And there's a lot of stuff to saying that they were escalating online. There were some clandestine organizations, news reporting organizations who had infiltrated some of the social media websites and the message boards of these white nationalist groups and learned that they had planned to use their vehicles to assault protesters, counter-protesters, should they come. And so it was no surprise what these clandestine reporting organizations were saying. It should have been no surprise that this thing happened, because they were literally talking about it. And what we know is that on that incident, the day of that incident, she wasn't there. The subject of the documentary wasn't there. And her mother called her. She was at work and her mother called her. And at this point, she was back in communication with her mother. And did I say that her mother died? Her mother did not die. Maybe it was her grandmother. Whatever. No, I'm thinking of the first story. So anyway, she was in contact with her mother. And her mother called her crying because she knew that she was in this white nationalist group, but she was trying to get out. And her mother said, "You got blood on your hands." And then this was the catalyst for her leaving the white nationalist group. Not anything else. Nothing else that she had experienced up to that point pushed her, moved her to leave the white nationalist group in Identity Europa. But literally the death and the harming of hundreds of, not hundreds, but like several other people. Carnage is the thing that had helped her to leave. And maybe I'm not being fair, but that's evil. You are only... She said from the beginning, I was just doing this. I was just going through the motions. So the thing that made you snap out of it wasn't the fact that you were going through the motions and you said that you didn't believe in the things that you were touting. She even said that she did a Seek Heil. She addressed one of them people with the Seek Heil, one of the bigger named people doing the Seek Heil, the Nazi salute. So you mean to tell me you went through the motions that hard for that many years and the only thing that snapped you out of it was carnage? And the interviewer did not push on these things. They didn't push in the ways that needed to be pushed. And so literally she's on here, up here playing a victim, but faking like she's not a victim. Like she's up there not as a victim, but she's being portrayed as a victim. She's not a victim. You are a willing participant in this. Wipe your tears. She didn't really cry. I applaud her for not crying uncontrollably and going down that road. And I can't imagine the guilt that she must be feeling. But what she can't, you cannot get through that guilt without owning up to what you did. Owning up to what led you there. That whole episode just disturbed me so deeply. It disturbed me so deeply. And then we go to the next episode that I actually watched, which is the sexploitation one, I think it's called. Sextortion. Where this guy was extorting women, women and girls who he met online, because of, it's a power thing again, just like with the first episode, the death by SWAT. It was a complete power trip, but the thing that just gets me is women, in this case, the women that were caught up in this, the women and girls, teenage girls who were caught up in this, freely exchanging. I don't know how I feel about it. I'm still trying to form how I feel about it. But he got a hold of intimate pictures of them and extorted them for their time, their money. Like when they got mad at him and were trying to disconnect from him, he would extort them. If you don't do what I need you to do, I'm gonna use your most intimate picture and share it with your world, everybody that you care about, and embarrass you. And that embarrassment was enough to guilt these women extort these women into doing what he wanted them to do. Most of them, and for a long period of time, until they just didn't care anymore. They were beyond the other side of shame that nothing fazed them, or that the prospect of them being exposed by him was outweighed by the sheer fact that they no longer wanted to be connected with him. And we know he goes to jail in the end. But the social media is not insidious in nature, but the ways in which we use it. And I think the lesson in the I'm Not a Nazi piece, more than her confusing story of just not taking responsibility, but also trying to expose the white nationalist movement and how you can get in there, it's not innocent. They're preying on a piece of you that desires that attention that it's giving you. And so social media itself is not on trial, but definitely our use of this thing is on trial. And this, if anything, this web of make-believe, this series, I don't necessarily think it was good reporting. I think it told some stories that might not have gotten any traction. I think the ex-neo-Nazi white nationalist piece is a story we need to talk about more, because there are, quite frankly, a ton of hate, white identity hate groups that exist in this, in the United States, but then also across the globe. Well, not across the globe, in majority white countries. And they need to be talked about more. We are all the time talking about terrorist organizations in brown countries. We need to be talking about the terrorist organizations that exist, the myriad terrorist organizations that exist, the white organizations that exist in Western cultures. Anyway, watch this series if you got the energy to, because that actually, I will call, watch the third episode when you're ready. Actually, watch the first episode when you're ready, because that made me mad. But at least there was a conclusion. At least the guy got caught. And while doxing isn't ever going to, well, it hasn't ended, this guy and the ways and, you know, the, I would like to think that the type of doxing that he was doing, the doxing for hire, is the thing of the past. I would like to believe that. The political, using death for political gains is never going to go out of fashion. But I hope we can just be a little bit more aware. And then the Nazi piece, I just need more stories of former Nazis as a way, just like we try to use ex-Taliban and ex-extremists from other groups to try to help deprogram folks who've been radicalized. We need that in the United States. We need it because there are more that exist than don't. Many of them teaching. I think that was one of the more disturbing things there, that there are teachers who are white nationalists who go to school trying to red pill students, radicalized students in school. And we don't want to talk about critical race theory. How about let's make sure that we get these red pillar people out of our school systems? How about that? Anyway, talked long enough. Yeah, this was disturbing, but it was also interesting too. And even though Netflix is still treading water next to HBO Max and Disney Plus and Paramount Plus and all of them, this happened to be one of the better, more interesting documentaries. It wasn't necessarily well, they could have pushed on their answers and pushed in the interview. But it was interesting stories. It's interesting, I'll say that. It's not perfect, it's very imperfect, but it's an interesting watch and you should watch it. All right, that is it for now. I've talked long enough. Thank you so much for listening. Take care of yourself. I hope you enjoyed Pride. I hope if you had a birthday like me, if you're my birthday twin, you know, hope you had a good birthday, twin. Happy summer. I'll be back next week. I don't know what I'm talking about, but I'll be back next week. Happy Juneteenth. Well, I already did the Juneteenth piece anyway. Yeah, take care of yourself. Please take care of yourself. You're the only you we got and we need you. Take care of yourself. And don't forget to share and like this episode with anyone that you think might be interested in it. Leave me a positive message, 4 or 5 stars. I will read it. Thank you in advance for helping to spread the reach of the show. Again, this is a hobby that I do. I still enjoy doing it. So I'm going to do it as long as it's still enjoyable. And right now it's still enjoyable. So amen. All right. Take care of yourself. Until next time.